Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. How about a critical examination of my ability to speak? I'm Paul Riismandel, and I'm your host on today's program. Webcasters and record labels meet together to make their case to Congress. As well, we'll hear about a new independent publishing project that takes a different spin on the typical zine. Oh, it's important stuff. You do want to stay tuned. Well, on July 26th, thousands of large and small U.S. webcasters turned off their stream of music as part of a protest called the Day of Silence. They're protesting the great increase in the royalties that they're expected to pay to the record industry as a result of a new royalty scheme that was approved by the Copyright Review Board, the Copyright Royalties Board in the United States, that dictates how much webcasters have to pay to record labels for the right in order to play recorded music. And by the way, this is not something which regular over-the-air broadcasters have to pay to the record labels. A couple days later, webcasters and record label representatives appeared in front of the House Committee on Small Business to make their individual cases about what Congress should or should not do about this potential threat to webcasting that could put a lot of small webcasters out of business. Nidia Velasquez is the chairwoman of the House Committee on Small Business. She is a Democrat from New York, and now we will listen to her set up and explain a little bit more about why webcasters and record labels are in front of the House Committee.
This morning, the committee will examine a recent decision by the Copyright Royalty Board that will increase the fees that internet radio broadcasters pay to play music. In advance of these new fees taking effect on July 15th, it is important to consider the challenge of providing fair compensation for artists and record labels while maintaining a business-friendly environment for webcasters. In May of this year, the Copyright Royalty Board set new rates at which commercial and non-commercial webcasters will compensate copyright owners. The CRB also established an annual minimum fee that these entities must pay for each channel provided by the service. In response to the CRB decision, internet radio providers have raised concerns about whether the new rates and minimum fees will put small internet radio broadcasters out of business. Artists and record companies, however, have praised the CRB decision as one that fairly compensates them for their music. This has prompted an important debate about copyright royalties that will continue beyond July 15th, when these new rates go into effect. As a result, today's hearings will review the impact of this ruling on small internet radio broadcasters, independent artists, and record labels. At the heart of the copyright royalties issue, it is the fact that the internet is changing the way consumers access and enjoy music. Music used to be distributed primarily via records, tapes, CDs, and traditional AM/FM radio. Now, an increasing amount of music is now distributed via audio files, network downloads, ringtone, satellite radio, HD radio, and internet radio. Data from 2006 confirms that a market shift is occurring in the music industry. Sales of CDs continued to fall last year, while subscriptions to digital music services, digital downloads of songs, albums, and ringtones all increased. At the same time, the number of subscribers to satellite radio and the number of people listening to internet radio has risen dramatically. Through internet radio broadcasters of all sizes offer webcast, many of the leading providers are small companies employing fewer than 50 employees. Given the consolidation of media ownership that we have seen in recent years, the growing popularity of a broad array of small and independent webcasters is a promising sign. Listeners want greater choice with respect to music content, and internet radio services of all sizes are providing just that. As popular as these services are today, new technologies are expected to make them even more popular in the future. When universal broadband access is realized, consumers will be able to access an even wider variety of entertainment than they are today. In order for this future to become a reality, there must be a business environment that allows new technologies to prosper and grow, while preserving incentives for artistic creativity. It is through this balance that we will best be able to promote innovation and ensure that America remains a leader in these emerging high technology sectors. The hearing today continues the committee's active role in addressing small business-related technology issues. These issues are indicative of the crucial and critical role that technology plays in the economy and in advancing U.S. competitiveness.
And that was Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez. She's the chairwoman of the House Committee on Small Businesses, sitting up and explaining the reason for a hearing the committee held on June 28th. Next, we'll listen to some testimony that came from a small webcaster who used to run, actually, a FM station in Oxford, Ohio. My wife used to live in Dayton, Ohio, and visiting her, I'd often try to listen to the station, WOXY, there in Oxford, which is in southwest Ohio, because it was a very unique commercial radio station there that had a very open format, played a lot of very interesting independent music, very different from most other commercial rock stations. Eventually, they were no longer able to stay on the FM dial because of costs, and instead became a web-only station. The manager of WOXY is going to explain a little bit more their situation and how they are threatened by the new royalty rates.
Good morning. My name is Brian J. Miller, and I am the general manager for WOXY.com, an internet broadcaster based in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you, Chairwoman Velazquez and Congressman Chabot, for holding this important hearing. I've had the unique experience of making the transition from a terrestrial FM radio station to an internet-only webcaster, and I hope I'm able to convey to this committee today the lessons I've learned over the course of my career and my reasons for opposing the recent increase of recording royalty rates for webcasters like myself. First, let me state unequivocally that whatever you hear and believe about big webcasters being able to pay higher royalties, the truth is that smaller independent webcasters are struggling to get by in this very exciting but still very young industry. There's a tremendous challenge to deliver the value and innovation listeners demand while maintaining a viable business. From my personal experience, the economics of running a standalone internet radio operation are daunting at best. Between bandwidth costs, hosting, music royalties, and rent, a small webcaster would be doing quite well to simply cover his or her costs, let alone have anything left over for payroll. And in fact, the revenues we've been able to generate in operating WOXY.com over the past several years have at best only covered half of our monthly expenses. In all the conversations that I've had with my peers, their situation isn't much better. Most draw no salary and are lucky to cover just their operating costs. The Copyright Royalty Board's decision is grossly out of sync with the economic reality of small webcasters. Even before the recent rate hike, financial hardship forced WOXY.com off the air and out of business last September. We were lucky enough to have been acquired by a larger company who has thus far been willing to subsidize our operation. Unfortunately, most webcasters facing these increased royalty rates don't have that luxury. I can guarantee that if WOXY.com had not been acquired and was still a standalone entity, the new royalties would have been the end of the road for us at that point. So why should you care about webcasters who are a hair's breadth from going under even before they face the higher royalty rates? I would argue that we deliver something so unique for artists and music fans that our existence should be supported and encouraged and not hindered during the early years of our industry. Musicians stand to lose valuable exposure provided by internet radio outlets. I believe that one of the reasons millions of people tune in to internet radio every month is that they're looking for something new. In the past 15 years, rampant consolidation amongst AM and FM broadcasters has led to a general homogenization of radio programming. Narrowing playlists and fewer artists are being exposed. Consumers are now turning to internet radio to discover new artists and find something that they're not going to get via their local AM or FM radio station. Countless artists have told us that listeners have approached them at concerts around the country, and they told them how they first discovered the band's music when they first heard it on WOXY.com. Today we're playing more than 400 songs from new artists, and in a given year we probably play about 10 times the number of songs as your average terrestrial radio station, and including 5 times as many independent artists who would otherwise never be heard on traditional radio. The musicians hurt most by this rate increase, I think, are the ones who today benefit the most from internet radio, and that would be new and emerging independent artists. Webcasters going out of business is a lose-lose for artists. Consumers will also lose if there's a mass extinction of independent internet radio stations. The growing audience of internet radio proves that there is a hunger for alternatives to mainstream media. With consumers' tastes becoming increasingly niched, internet radio has the ability to serve an unlimited number of channels of programming uniquely suited to fulfill this need. For example, stations dedicated to genres like honky-tonk or even children's music could never exist on FM broadcast radio. But confined by geography and limited by space on the dial, traditional radio could never offer this type of programming. But online, these formats have found a worldwide audience, and they're thriving today. Unfortunately, the short-sighted $500 per channel minimum fee in the CRB's decision would make serving thousands of channels of custom programming financially impossible. I fear that the future of internet radio under the new performance royalty rates will look wildly different from the thousands of small, vibrant, eclectic stations that you see today. A select few, mostly larger corporate webcasters, may be able to pay the increased royalties by subsidizing their internet broadcasting operations with non-webcast revenues, in effect using internet radio as a loss leader for their other products. But I truly believe that net radio as we know it and the opportunities it offers will be a thing of the past if the Copyright Royalty Board's decision is not overturned. Thousands of established and budding small businesses will vanish, and although I believe internet broadcasting has the potential to grow into a thriving, profitable industry, currently the revenue structure is simply not there to support the additional royalties.
That was Brian J. Miller of WOXY, also known as WOXY, now a web radio station, formerly a FM radio station out of Oxford, Ohio, speaking about the effect of the new web radio royalty rates on small webcasters. After the testimony, Representative Velasquez, the chairwoman of the House Committee on Small Business, did say that she'd prefer that webcasters and the record industry work out their own compromise rather than having the Congress do that. Nevertheless, there are 121 sponsors now of the Internet Radio Equality Act, which would turn back the clock on the royalty rates to what they were previously and holding them in effect until 2010. A sponsor of that bill includes Tim Johnson, who is the representative, a Republican here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and along with 120 others. The new royalties now are expected to go into effect July 15th, which could be the date in which a lot of small webcasters are hurt. Now, a compromise was offered by record labels and Sound Exchange about a month ago, rejected by the webcasters as a whole. It proposed having some reduced rates for small webcasters, but the webcasters themselves believe that the definition for a small webcaster was too narrow and too easily outgrown. As a webcaster grew and got a bigger audience, it might mean they had to pay higher royalties before they could actually afford them. Now, as we go to air today, June 29th, I just get a press release saying that Sound Exchange has now made another proposal to webcasters to have a voluntary cap on the minimum fees charged on royalties played on internet radio. The proposal caps advance payments at $2,500 per service, whereas current regulations would have a webcasting service pay $500 minimum fee per station or channel, regardless of the overall number of stations or channels they're streaming. By making this offer, Sound Exchange says that it, quote, is addressing certain webcasters' concern about their liability for per-channel minimums. And this particularly addresses the concerns of a service called Pandora, which makes individualized channels and streams for individual listeners based upon their listening preferences, which made them worry that they would have to pay $500 per the for each of these streams, which would mean $500 per listener as a minimum rate. No word yet on what the webcasters think about that. So things are still moving along. It's also reported that Sound Exchange is currently in active negotiations with small commercial webcasters on the side, as well as non-commercial webcasters such as public radio and college radio stations in order to provide below market rates rather than treating them as if they are commercial entities. It will be interesting to see how things work out here for web radio. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at a world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. And this is the critical examination going on right here, since these new royalty rates really provide, I think, a possible huge threat to independent radio on the internet, especially to community stations and other community-minded broadcasters rather than commercial broadcasters who don't make a profit on their streams and are often just holding it together to be able to pay for the service and stay going. Could really be debilitated by having to pay high royalties to the record industry. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. Download this program at Radio.MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments, send them to me, Paul@MediaGeek.net. Next, we're going to change gears a little bit and talk a little bit about one independent media project, a publishing project, taking kind of a different view on The Zine, an independently published magazine-type periodical publication. We're going to hear from Matt Kessler and Zach Hilsing, who have a new little publishing operation called iRocket. It is EYE Rocket. And now Zach will tell us a little bit more about this project.
The zine we have coming out now is called Work Cited, and it is a collection of documents that you might find at a school, maybe a grade school as well as high school. And we just kind of thought there was free rein for us to explore the kinds of things that go on at school.
Yeah, it started out like Zach had this paper that he'd, when he went to college, someone had turned in a paper, like they were in a paper writing class and they'd exchanged papers. And this guy wrote this paper about heavy metal. And the Works Cited list was like Manowar, Anthrax, Metallica, Saint Augustine, and it was just basically heavy metal band after heavy metal band, and had these really ridiculous sentences about differentiating between true metal and false metal,
and our Viking heritage,
and yeah, the claim to European Viking heritage. And this is an essay that, I mean, we've had and we've passed around to all of our friends for about 5 or 6 years, and so we sat down to the drawing board and we were like, man, we really have to use this essay. You know, we have to share it with everybody. And so that was basically the starting point, because it was, you know, we loved Works Cited, Anthrax, Metallica, Manowar. Like, I think there were 7 or 8 Sepultura discs mentioned. And so, yeah, we just kind of worked from there and we found everything that we liked from school that we thought was funny from school. Zach has some drawings that he did when he was a little kid of girls and boys he didn't like eating poop and licking boogers off their face. And so then that was basically the starting point, and we just sort of built around that.
Portrait of the artist as a young schoolboy.
Sure.
Yeah.
as a college-age metalhead.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, why choose to sort of self-publish it and put it together as a zine?
Well, I think we came to that conclusion that we had to do that, and we came to it from several different places. Me personally, I'm an artist or illustrator and whatnot, and I find the whole art scene, that being around galleries and the fine art world, to be, I don't know, it's not really my bag. I wouldn't want to knock it, but it's it just doesn't really work out for me, and I don't find it very comfortable, and I don't find that I make work that I respond to when I'm making for that world. And so I guess it just came to the point where it was necessary to self-publish, because there was nothing satisfactory out there. And then Matt came to it, I guess, from a totally different angle.
Yeah, like for a living, I do audio editing for Books on Tape. And also, you know, I guess before, like, this is probably about 3 or 4 years ago, like, I wanted to go the traditional route. Like, you know, I wanted to write books that got published through like Random House or, you know, whatever. And I guess like the first reason I came to wanting to self-publish and all this stuff was that I went to a writing conference that actually like a really good book line McSweeney's was putting on, and it was sort of like a Q&A session. It was like a panel, and they had the editor from Tin House, who, and he was really cool. And then they had like a former senior editor from Grove Press, a couple published writers, and basically they were like, "Yeah, well, you know, this is New York, and you know, if you want your writing to be published, you know, you really should like think about like gender stuff or you know this or that." And it wasn't even, you know, some of their advice was really disheartening. And the other thing about it was just the way they were interacting with each other. I could tell like what an industry it was, you know. And I'd kind of thought of books as being this like, I don't know why, like the sacred thing, like not an industry, like not like MTV, you know, not like clothes, fashion industry. But I mean, all industries are industries. They're guided by small groups of people that have rules, that have values, you know, that they're going to basically that your art or your work has to conform to. And so like when you're making this stuff, even if you aren't directly concerned with that, I mean, it becomes this thing, like this concern that you have with the work, like how is it going to get out? How is it going to get published? And, you know, so why not just take that into your own hands? I mean, so that's kind of, you know, I mean, it's a lot of grunt work and it's a lot of boring stuff that you have to deal with. But, I mean, our take on it was, you know, man, we really need to do this ourselves. We should take it in on ourselves. And, I mean, that's the culture that we came from. You know, me and Zach, like, we grew up listening to a lot of, you know, like, sort of punk bands, like, on Discord Records and Kill Rock Stars. And that's what we really liked. And that was just run by kids. And, if you want to create something immediate, you have to do it yourself. I mean, there's no point not to. I mean, just, you know, it's easy to do.
So the form of this zine isn't like even like a typical zine, which is often, you know, digest size. It's several pieces of paper stapled together at the spine. Instead, yours comes in a envelope, which has been hand decorated, but looks like a medical file or a file you might find in somebody's drawer in an office, maybe a school office somewhere. Tell me more about this design that you've put together for the zine.
The design took a little while to come to. It was just kind of a work in progress. As we started out, I think, probably thinking about doing more of a standard zine, and that definitely is what we were doing. And then as we started to get these random documents, we knew we wanted to feel like you were actually having the documents. For example, in the zine, there is a paper, I guess like a paper that somebody had written, the metal essay. And when we were going with the old format, we kind of had to fudge it and make it look like it had been scanned in and then placed inside the zine. And it just looked really fake. And the idea came across it'd be so much better if the reader actually got something that looked exactly like a paper, like you had just gone into a classroom and seen the paper sitting there, and you pick it up, and it's even got marks on it as if it had, you know, it's been graded and things, there are spelling errors that have been, you know, checked off. And it just was, there was a logic that was, you know, could be consistently upheld if we went to this format. And it's also more fun. As we broke the old format, we found that there were a lot more things we could do, a lot more things we can include, and just a lot of new places to go with the zine.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, we're thinking of these. We're not mass producing it. You know, we don't have an audience of like 20,000 people. So why not take advantage of that? Why make a zine that tries to look like a magazine that, you know, Condé or whatever would publish? You know, why not take advantage of those opportunities? And so we decided to make something. You know, we're making something that I don't believe HarperCollins or Flint Publishing could make, because it takes too much time. It takes too much personal attention for each object.
You say that you want this to be a smaller press. So this is not just a one-off project. This is part of what I guess you see as an imprint,
yeah,
which you call iRocket.
That's correct, yeah. It's it's a book label, or a label, I shouldn't say books, or whatever label. And it is called iRocket, and we're hoping to at least do quarterly releases, if not maybe bi-monthly. That doesn't mean bi-monthly, you know, of the same thing. We hope to do a different thing every 2 months and put it out. We have some upcoming releases. We have a book that's coming out in November called The National Science Fair of Amazing New Discoveries. And we have a bunch of different projects already sort of worked out as far as, like, we know what they're going to be. We don't know which formats they're going to take, but we know what content-wise the theme is going to be. So, yeah, I mean, this is... We're gonna be around, you know. We're gonna be putting all that stuff out.
How do you intend to make a go with this? I realize you're starting, you know, you're just getting started here with a fairly small project. Do you have any sense of how you can take each step next down the line?
Yeah, it's really difficult. We want to do this like as grassroots as we can. I mean, just politically speaking, we're so against this sort of corporate landscape that you see everywhere, you know. So with a business, just because you're doing a business, that doesn't mean you have to be corporate. Businesses can be very good things. They can enable dialogue. And what we want to do is we want to do this as sort of grassroots. I mean, I guess these are cliche words to use around, but populist, grassroots as possible. So, I mean, there's been a lot of problems right now. The culture where we grew up, that we grew up in, I mean, it's really sort of dying away. We've been talking to stores, you know, a lot of independent stores. We've got a lot of stores in St. Louis and Chicago and Portland, Oregon that we work with regularly. And we're going to keep working with them. We want to set up, you know, they have these renegade craft fairs. We'll probably be doing stuff through at there and at shows, and we want to be like a physical presence, so it's not just something you sort of see at the store too. I mean, we kind of want people to be able to, we want to interact with our audience.
Well, I think that might be a segue into this this party that we're going to be having soon.
Yeah.
And I think the idea behind that was that we do want to have, we want to announce the presence, we want to announce the launch of this zine when it's finished. And the way we've thought was the best fit for that would be to have a party, just a party. There's, you know, nothing really else going on with it, but just as a celebration, and to hopefully bring people on board, and that fun that we took into the project, and that fun that we continue to have throughout every aspect of the project is very important to us. And we want that mentality or that feel to come across with the presentation and with the total experience of it, of reading it. And it's supposed to be an enjoyable, tactile experience for people.
We're going to decorate the space a little. For each launch, we're going to decorate the space accordingly or do different things that fit each release.
And that was Matt Kessler and Zach Hilsing from iRocket Press. You can look at their website, irocketbooks.com. And that party they're talking about for people in Champaign-Urbana is at the Open Source Art Space at 12 East Washington Street, downtown Champaign, on Saturday, July 7th at 10 p.m. It is a party for the release of their zine project, Works Cited, which you just heard about. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, Institute and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.